Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin with us this hour for Open Forum. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, about Catholic beliefs, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Of course, as you very likely know, unless you're new to the program, and if you are new to the program, welcome. We're happy to have you here with us. Jimmy's pretty open to any question you've got. If you want to ask a question of a more generally religious or ethical, philosophical nature, or something having to do with the intersection of science and faith, or if you just want to know something about Deep Space Nine or Battlestar Galactica, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and also the author of many things, including his most recent book, which is entitled The Bible is a Catholic Book. And he's also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cy.
Is it better to say titled or entitled? I never know.
It works both ways.
Oh, okay. All right, good. I'm entitled to do it either way then. 888-318-7884, the number. Jimmy, people know you're on, and already every single line is full. So I think head right to the questions. What do you think?
That sounds good.
All right. Another call from Australia. Let's go to Lucky in Sydney, Australia, watching on YouTube Live. Lucky, your question for Jimmy.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. My question today is, essentially, how do we renew the Catholic parish? I think that oftentimes in Australia, parishes or Catholics, supposedly Catholic families, sometimes by no fault of their own, really struggle to form young people in the faith in an authentic way. And to me, this sort of stems from the parish. So I'm wondering if we can renew that and how we can do that in this pivot point in the age of Corona and beyond.
All right, Jimmy, how about that? Renewing the Catholic parish.
There's not a single answer to this because different parishes have different challenges that they're facing. And so you really have to approach the situation kind of diagnostically, kind of like a doctor would. And it's ultimately the bishop's job to do that. And to another extent, the pastor's job, but the laity can play a role here. And part of that is a discernment process of trying to figure out what the challenges that a particular parish faces are, and then doing things to address those challenges. Now, in some cases, let's say the pastor just doesn't have a lot of energy. He's not a very energetic pastor. He's not encouraging people to take on challenges in the parish. Well, there might be things, there's a limit to what the laity can do. It's really the bishop's job to deal with a pastor who's not doing his job as well as he could. But there are things the laity can do. One of the things is obviously pray for their pastors. And that goes all the way up, including the bishop and the pope. But also, there might be things that they could do to help their parish priest or priests get more engaged. I mean, they might find a way to stimulate their interest. And one of the ways of doing that is by volunteering, because, you know, as in any organization, it's easy to say, hey, why don't we start a new program to reach the youth of our parish? But there's a limit to what people are able to do. And so typically in organizations, the people who propose a program are often the ones that need to carry it out. And so I would say, you know, if you're concerned about the youth in your parish not being sufficiently engaged in their faith, get involved in the parish youth program, volunteer to do some stuff. There are also programs that are specifically focused on parish renewal, but and you could explore those. But if there's a particular concern in your parish, like the youth here are not engaged enough, the obvious thing to me is volunteer to do some youth ministry. And you may need to have some preliminary stages in that. You might, for example, need to get certified as a youth catechist or something like that. But basically, get engaged, ask other people to get engaged, and set an example by being engaged yourself.
How's that for you, Lucky?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's early Saturday morning there in Sydney, isn't it?
Yeah, 9 a.m.
Oh, well, very nice. Thank you for joining us on this Saturday morning in Australia. Again, Jimmy Akin.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. God bless you, brother. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy, it's Friday. I got to ask, what's on the mysterious world today, Jimmy Akin's mysterious world?
Well, this is a bit of an unusual week. Last Friday, we did part one of a two-parter on reincarnation. And so we didn't want to make people wait a whole week for that. So we dropped part two on Monday so they could get closure quickly. Spoiler, reincarnation does not happen. But that means for this Friday, what we did is we released a special episode answering questions from our patrons. So we answered questions about bilocation and Oak Island and Padre Pio and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Very cool. And you can get that right now. Just Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. There's only one of them. You'll find it. Again, our number here, 888-318-7884. Dan in Wyoming, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, is next. Dan, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Jimmy, I'm listening to the Bible as a Catholic Book audiobook version. Great job. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
How's the reader? Do you enjoy the person reading it?
Yeah, he does a great job. He actually acts like he wrote it.
I mean, all right, good. Go ahead with your question.
In referring to the crucifixion in Luke chapter 23, verse 49, it says, "And all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee stood at a distance and saw these things." All his acquaintances. Are the apostles included in that, all his acquaintances?
That would seem to be the inference. Now, Luke doesn't say explicitly, but based on the fact that he says all his acquaintances, well, that's people who knew him, and most of those people would have come from Galilee. And since he also mentions as a separate group the women who followed from Galilee, that would imply that the acquaintances he's referring to are principally composed of men from Galilee who came down. And that's a really good description of the apostles. Also, if you read earlier in Luke's Gospels, who are the people that are portrayed as Jesus's acquaintances? Primarily, it's the apostles. So absolutely, it does seem to be the apostles were all there, at least. I mean, we can't say every single one, but that would seem, except Judas, but that would seem to be the implication here. And so I think Christian art has done us something of a disservice by often portraying it as if it was only the women and the beloved disciple who were at the crucifixion. That is not the evidence we have from the Gospels.
Okay, Dan?
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you, Dan. Our number, again, 888-318-7884. When Jimmy's here on a Friday, or anytime Jimmy's here to do an open forum with us, you know those lines are going to fill up, so you might have to dial more than once. Hey, right now, store-wide spring sale continues, and I'm told now, today, in my hot little hand is the notice. It only goes for two more weeks. So all of our books, CDs, DVDs, MP3s, ebooks, everything on sale, 10 to 25% off, in a few cases more than that. School of Apologetics is on sale. Each course is $50 off, and it's you get it all. You can access it all at shop.catholic.com. And if you need something right away, there's as the caller just said, Jimmy read his book. I think that was, you were the first person here to make an audiobook out of your book. Is that right, Jimmy?
Yeah, Trent did one also.
Trent did too. So there's a lot of stuff you can download if you just want to get it now. And it's ebooks, e-magazines, the MP3s, all of that accessible and on sale right now at shop.catholic.com.
Your questions, Catholic answers, live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards is our show for young adults.
Everybody's talking about Encounter. Everybody's talking about that mountaintop experience. What we fail to often talk about is what happens after. What happens beyond that Damascus moment?
Jesus Christ is calling all of us to be missionary disciples, disciples of Jesus who are on mission to bring the kingdom of God here and now on this earth.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards, tomorrow at 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Exaggerating, these phones just keep filling up. So if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin during this hour of open forum, go ahead and keep dialing 888-318-7884. Oh, the people from Australia are all getting in, so you'll probably get in sooner or later, but man, those lines are filling up. TJ in Texas is next. TJ is watching on YouTube Live. TJ, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, sir. Good evening. My question is lately I've been kind of really stressing out about I'm getting ready to get married and getting ready to provide for my family and whatnot, financially and whatnot. And I'm trying to get more and more money, if I can, out of work.
Yeah.
And it led me to kind of reflect to Luke. There's two passages where a rich man came to Jesus, asked what he had to do to get into heaven. And Jesus basically said, last thing for you to do is sell all your possessions and follow me. Well, a second person somewhere in Luke came to Jesus and told him, I repaid all of my debts, all of the people that I've cheated, and I sold half of my possessions. And Jesus basically told him that he was righteous and he had good faith. So what is the healthy desire for wealth in the Catholic Church?
Well, so Jesus is famous for having said that the love of money is the source of all different kinds of evil. So there is an acquisitiveness that is sinful, where you just put money above everything else and are willing to do unscrupulous things in order to obtain it. But as long as you're not doing unscrupulous things by acquiring money, it's not wrong because you're not being unscrupulous. And so it's legitimate to work with your hands and enjoy the fruit of your labors. Jesus himself said the worker is worth his wages. And so consequently, Jesus acknowledges that there is a legitimate need for people to acquire money in order to provide for their families. He indicates it's not the thing we to be most concerned with. He talks, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel about how put God's kingdom first, you know, focus on making sure you're pleasing God, and then God will add to you all these other things. So you don't need to say to yourself, what shall we eat or what shall we drink or what shall we wear? Put, you know, your Father in heaven already knows you need those things. And so right there, Jesus acknowledges we need them. And in the pursuit of those things, we want to make sure we put God first and make our primary concern in life pleasing him, rather than acquiring our material needs, and it'll work out. We'll get our material needs covered. In the case of the two people you mentioned in Luke's gospel, so there are parallels in Mark and Matthew about the rich young ruler who comes to Jesus and says, what do I need to do? And Jesus says, well, you know the commandments. And so he indicates to get into heaven, you just need to keep God's commandments. And the guy then says, well, I've done all those since I was a boy. What else should I do? And Jesus says, well, if you want to be perfect, sell your possessions and follow me. So he's inviting the man to a life of what's called apostolic poverty, to be a full-time follower of Jesus like the other apostles were. Now, today, it's not possible to follow Jesus in that exact way. Some people do, though, consecrate their lives to Jesus by, say, joining a religious community. You know, they could become a monk or a nun. And in doing that, they do live a life of evangelical poverty. But that's not everybody's calling. Notice Jesus already answered his question, what to do to get into heaven. He says, well, keep the commandments. If you want to do more than that, though, here's something you could do. And so that's the fancy word for something that goes beyond what's required in theology is supererogatory. So, you know, it's supererogatory or more than what's required to like live a life of voluntary poverty, but it's not required to do that. Jesus recognizes that the worker is worth his wages. In the other instance you mentioned, that's the tax collector Zacchaeus. And one of the things about tax collectors in this era was they were basically what are sometimes called tax farmers. The Romans would demand that they turn over a certain amount of money, but the tax collector could collect more than that and keep the residue himself. And so tax collectors had a reputation for being unscrupulous and doing things that they collected more money than the Romans required them to and more than they needed. They would just squeeze people for additional tax money. And that's what Zacchaeus is repenting of. Zacchaeus has said, I recognize that what I've done is wrong, so I'm going to give away half of what I have. And if I've wronged anybody, I'll pay him back more than he paid me. So I'm going to do restitution to anybody I've wronged. And Jesus at that point says, salvation has come to this house today because Zacchaeus has repented. But notice, it's not that Zacchaeus... it's not that it's wrong to collect taxes. It's that Zacchaeus is repenting of things he's done before. In fact, earlier in Luke's gospel, if you read the account of John the Baptist at the beginning of Luke's gospel, say about chapter 3, tax collectors do come to John the Baptist and say, what should we do in order to repent and inherit the kingdom? And he says, well, don't collect any more than you have to. So one can be a tax collector in a legitimate way, but many tax collectors went beyond that and collected more than they needed to in a way that hurt people. And so that's what Zacchaeus is repenting of. So we shouldn't look at Zacchaeus's example as what we all need to do. It's what Zacchaeus needed to do because of his particular situation. For most of us, the advice we find in Matthew's gospel is the key. Make God our first priority, trust him to help us find what we need, and then work and we'll be worth the wages we receive.
Okay, TJ.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Hey, God bless you, and congratulations on your impending marriage.
Yeah.
Thank you. Y'all stay healthy.
Well, we're trying. We're doing our best. I don't know why. I just have a feeling that eating chocolate Easter eggs with peanut butter in the middle of them is part of a good health regimen right now. I don't know that there's any science behind that, but that's my feeling about the whole thing. Emma in Hayden, Idaho, you are next. Emma, your question for Jimmy.
Guess what?
What?
I can hear you.
You can.
Good.
Okay. Everybody always says, can you hear me?
Oh, never mind. You got me, hey, Emma.
I got you.
That's funny.
Okay. And I think they cast lots is when they crucified Jesus and he had died. And I believe the guards are casting lots to get his robe. And it says mm-hmm. the robe was seamless. Does that have any significance to it?
It's something that I haven't dug back into. I haven't verified this for myself, but it is commonly understood that the high priest wore a seamless garment, and consequently that Jesus's seamless garment is indicative of his role as a priest. And he wasn't obviously a priest of the tribe of Levi, so he wasn't qualified to serve as a Jewish priest. But as the book of Hebrews explains, he is, as the Son of God, a priest in his own right, and wearing a priest-like garment helps bring that out.
That makes sense.
Yeah. All right. Now, it may not have been understood by everybody back then as that's the significance, but at least looking back on this fact, many Christians have said, that's an illustration of his priestly role.
Right, and that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Can I ask one more quick question?
We took
What's
a vote.
That?
Yes, you can.
Okay, what do monks do?
What do monks do? Well, monks are male religious, and they do a variety of different things depending on the charism of their order. But in broad terms, they like nuns and other religious, they consecrate their lives to God. They typically live the three evangelical counsels of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And monks do in community. That makes them different, for example, than hermits who tend to live alone. There are a variety of different male religious orders that have monks. Some monks are also priests, but not all monks are. And different particular monasteries and different particular orders have charisms that they pursue. They have different types of work that they pursue. Some monks make coffee. Some monks make wine. Some monks raise crops. They have a variety of different ways of supporting themselves. I was in New Jersey once and was driving along and saw a monastery that advertised itself as the fine dining monastery. And I was a little struck by that because I don't normally associate monks with fine dining, but apparently that's one of the ways they raised money for their order.
Emma, thank you very much for both questions and for starting us off with a little humor. Let's go to Whitney in San Antonio, Texas, listening on 98.7 FM Guadalupe Radio. Whitney, your question for Jimmy.
No, it's Whitey.
Oh, Whitey, I apologize. I'm glad to have you on, Whitey.
Okay, listen, I'm going to tell you something. The Bible says in Mark 16, these signs shall follow them that believe. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover. This is not a joke. Jesus said it, and he meant it. Nobody is doing that anywhere. We got an epidemic going on. There's millions of Catholic priests around the world, Protestant preachers. None of them are doing it. So something is definitely wrong here.
Why, Jimmy, why aren't we laying hands on people and healing them if Jesus said we could?
Well, so Jesus said that this is something that's going to characterize his followers, at least in a general way, but that doesn't mean every individual follower is empowered to do this. God could give an individual Christian the gift of healing charismatically. And so that sometimes happens. But the only people who are guaranteed to be able to exercise a kind of religious healing ministry from a Catholic point of view, are priests. Properly ordained priests are able to perform the sacrament of the anointing of the sick. And it is being performed. There are lots of priests who are willing to go perform it. Unfortunately, not all hospitals are allowing them to have access to patients. And so there's a limit to what priests are able to do. And personally, I think hospitals need to make the sacraments more available to people, even if it means sending the priest in a hazmat suit. Those things would be possible. One thing we have to be careful of, though, is thinking that just because the anointing of the sick or a charismatic minister who has a gift of healing are working to try to help people, this is still subject to God's will. God does not give us a guarantee, and even this passage here in Mark does not give us a guarantee that people are going to be healed in every single case. We know that because we see other instances in the New Testament where people were sick and were not simply healed. St. Paul himself talks about in Galatians how he had to stop in Galatia because of an illness. And that's why he ended up preaching there for the first time, because he had to interrupt his missionary journey because he was sick and he wasn't simply automatically healed. One of his other fellow Christians who was traveling with him couldn't just lay hands on him and heal him in that case. It wasn't God's will. Similarly, in the pastoral epistles, Paul tells Timothy to not drink only water anymore, but to take a little wine for the sake of his stomach and his frequent illnesses. So apparently Timothy, like a lot of people in the ancient world, had gastrointestinal troubles that drinking some wine with its alcohol could help, since the alcohol would kill the microorganisms. Paul didn't know that part, but he did know that it would help, and it does that, we now know, by killing microorganisms that can make people sick at the stomach. So that was another instance where somebody who was a minister of God wasn't simply automatically healed. So we have to recognize that even though healing ministry will characterize Jesus' disciples in a broad way, that doesn't mean we have a promise of healing in every specific case. It's still subject to God's will.
Thanks, Whitey. Appreciate that. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's Open Forum. We've got some great podcasts right now. And if you haven't been into podcasts before and you're thinking maybe this is the time, given that you might have a little more time, we've got What Do Catholics Believe About the Angels up right now with Father Hugh. We've got a discussion with Tim Staples about the early church was Eucharistic. And over at the Council of Trent, Matt Walsh and the cosmological argument. If you go over to Catholic.com or if you go to CatholicAnswersFocus.com, you can find out about these podcasts. And you can always find Jimmy's podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, just by Googling Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. We're doing our part. Go find those podcasts.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Lots and lots of folks on the line, but lines do open up as we proceed, so you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Next up, Tim in Boston, Massachusetts, listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Tim, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
My question is, if Satan was originally in heaven, but got ejected for leading a rebellion, does that mean that if we succeed at getting into heaven ourselves, we could also be tempted to do something that to get us thrown out?
The standard understanding is no, we cannot. The way the will works in outside of this life is it's fixed on either good or evil. And so at some point, God... For humans in this life, God gives us a mutable will that can go back and forth between good and evil. And then when we die and we're no longer in this life, it becomes fixed on either good or evil. And it will remain that way through the rest of eternity, because even when we're restored in the resurrection, we're no longer in what's called our probationary state, which is this life. We're in another life. And so even in our resurrected bodies, our will remain fixed either on good or on evil, and so consequently, we won't fall. Now, if our will is fixed on good, that doesn't mean we'll lose all form of free will. We could still, for example, choose among different goods, but we won't be choosing evil anymore, and so we won't fall. Now, in terms of angels, the standard understanding is that God gave them a probationary time, just like he gave us. For them, it wasn't in a physical life, though, because by nature, they're created intellects. They don't natively have bodies the way we do. But he did give them an option to choose for or against him, and their wills then became fixed. So the good angels had their wills fixed on good, the bad angels had their wills fixed on bad, and so they don't go back and forth either now. All of the good angels are going to remain good, all of the bad angels are going to remain bad. There's a question about exactly when in their history the angels had this probation, when they had this option of choosing good or bad. A common opinion, theologically, is that it happened at the very first moment of their existence. So it's like God created an angel, gave them a choice, and the angel, of course, had all the knowledge they needed to make that choice. He created them with that knowledge. But then they made their choice and became confirmed in that. Now, whether it happened at the first moment of their existence, that's a theological opinion. It's not a matter of church teaching, so far as I've been able to establish. But like us, they did have this choice to make. And once the choice is made for both angels and humans, it becomes fixed. So if you make the right choice, you don't have to worry about falling.
How's that, Tim?
That answers my question. Thank you.
Ah, very good. Great. Happy Easter, Tim. Thank you for the call. Let's go now to Joe in Fort Collins, Colorado, listening on 1060 AM. Joe, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, blessed Easter to you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You too.
I've been reading a booklet by Father Michael Gatley called The Divine Mercy Explained. My question is, what is the thrust of the novena of Divine Mercy, the Chapel of Divine Mercy, which starts Good Friday and then ends on Saturday? And then Divine Mercy Sunday, what is the general thrust difference on that? And if the graces, as it were different, plenary, like a plenary indulgence.
Okay, so I'm afraid I haven't read this booklet, and I'm not an expert in the writings of St. Faustina, so I'm probably not the right person to ask some of those questions of. The Church has offered a plenary indulgence on Divine Mercy Sunday, and it's you can look online for an explanation of the usual conditions of a plenary indulgence, and specifically for the Divine Mercy Sunday one. It was established a number of years ago by John Paul II. But my understanding is in the writings of Saint Faustina, there is a report of a private revelation that she received that offered something kind of even better than a plenary indulgence. It was like a plenary indulgence, but you didn't have to meet all of the usual conditions for it. It was broader than that. That's something that you're permitted to believe since the apparition is approved, but it's not something that's a matter of church teaching, that there is this even broader availability. What the Church has done is established a plenary indulgence for Divine Mercy Sunday if you meet the usual conditions for a plenary indulgence, but it seems that St. Faustina reported that there's some even additional graces that are available. But it's been a while since I've looked into the details of that, so I'd have to refer you to someone who's more up on those details than I am at the moment.
And Joe, we'll leave it there. I'm realizing we have a lot of callers to get to and not a lot of time left. So we'll go to Emily in Alabama, watching on YouTube Live. Emily, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. I was recently attending a Baptist Bible study where the preacher was telling us that they were saved, they were being saved, and they were going to be saved. And he told me later that Catholics believe, and I'm Catholic, that we are saved by sacraments and not by Christ. And I said that we are saved by Christ through the sacraments. And I wondered, did I get that right? And what else might I say, or what scriptures might I reference for him?
Well, I would say that you got it right. The sacraments are instruments that Christ uses to give his grace, his saving grace to us. So they're sometimes called means of salvation because they're means or instruments by which he gives us his saving grace. And that's not something that's unique to Catholics. That's something that's actually believed by a lot of Protestants. Martin Luther, it was, for example, was very firm on the fact that baptism is a means of salvation, that baptism saves you. You could point him, if this Baptist pastor thinks that Protestants don't accept this, I would point him to Martin Luther's short catechism, where Luther had a shorter one and a longer one. I'd point him to the shorter one, where Luther is very, very explicit about this in the section on baptism. So this is not unique to Catholics. It's actually something that is recognized by basically all Christians except certain groups within Protestantism, like Baptists. Other Protestants are perfectly happy to talk about baptism and other sacraments as means of salvation, at least baptism in the Eucharist. They may not believe everything we believe about those sacraments, but they do recognize that they're means of grace. In terms of, I would also point out that just because something is a means doesn't result in you being able to say it's not Christ that's doing it. Christ is the one who instituted the sacraments. It was Christ's death on the cross that provided the grace that comes to us through the sacraments, and Christ himself is active in the sacraments. So from a Catholic point of view, when someone baptizes you, Christ is that person is just acting as Christ's agent. Christ is really the one doing the baptism from God's perspective. Similarly, even though a priest is celebrating the Eucharist here on earth, Christ is the primary sacrificing priest in the Eucharist in heaven. So it's Christ who's active in the sacraments. It's his death that provided the grace for them. And it's he who actually founded them. So it is Christ saving us. He's just doing it through the sacraments. Now, your Baptist pastor friend might say, ah, well, if you're saying he's doing it through something, that means you're in some degree relying on something other than Christ. Okay, if he proposes that principle, that's where and by the way, there are a lot of Bible verses that talk about, you know, like 1 Peter 3:21, baptism now saves you. And in John 6, you need to eat the flesh and drink the blood of the Son of Man, or you're not going to have life in you. So there are verses that talk about the saving role of the sacraments. But if he says, well, if you're trusting in a sacrament, you're putting at least some of your trust in something other than Christ, if there's an instrument by which he gives you this grace. Well, let's think about that from the Baptist perspective for a second. Are there things that this pastor would likely acknowledge are instruments that are used in bringing salvation to people? Well, there probably are. How about preaching? You know, St. Paul talks about how are people going to get saved if there's no one to preach to them? And how are people going to preach if they're not sent on a preaching mission? Well, preaching the gospel is acknowledged by Baptists typically as a means of helping people have salvation. And so you could take, well, look, if you're saying that any means that gets used in bringing you salvation means you're trusting in that means rather than in Jesus, then that's going to undermine your own position, because by saying people need to preach like St. Paul does in order to bring people salvation, that means you're really trusting in the preaching. You're not really trusting in Jesus. But if he says, well, okay, maybe there can be means of bringing people salvation, like preaching, so we can trust fully in Jesus, even though preaching is a means of helping people come to salvation, then the same thing's going to apply to the sacraments. You can say, okay, so baptism and the other sacraments are just means by which Christ gives his grace to us. We're not trusting in them. We're trusting in Jesus, the same way you would say you're trusting in Jesus and not in preaching.
Now, how does that strike you?
That's a lot of good information. Thank you.
Very good, Emily. Appreciate the call. Appreciate the question. I appreciate you. Saying exactly the right thing, that Christ saves us through the sacraments. That was very impressive.
Yeah. By the way, if she wants more Bible verses on the sacraments and salvation, just go to Catholic.com and type in like sacraments, Bible verses, or the names of particular sacraments like baptism. A lot of resources will come up.
We'll take a quick break. Emily, thanks again. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I just want to share that 5 years ago, my lovely warrior princess and saint of a wife and I decided to adopt a little girl through foster care. She is the perfect roundout of our family of three boys and her. Yes, there are challenges. Very grateful today for all the blessings that he has shown our family.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Open Forum. Up next is Joe in Guam, listening on Catholic.com. Joe in Guam, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, thank you so much, and I really appreciate listening to Catholic Answers. I learned so much, but very quickly here. I have a friend that he's a Catholic, and and also, I have some friends that are non-Catholic. But the question is, how can you say to somebody who tries to really convince them that the Catholic Bible is the true Bible? There's so many Bibles out, and I'm just trying to get my hands and to try to really come to a more convincing side to convince them that, yeah, the Catholic Bible is the true Bible. And I do have another second question, if I may just ask it now.
Well, wait, hang on, because I want Jimmy to get to that question, because Jimmy actually wrote the book on this. So the question, Jimmy, is how can he convince or establish with people that the Catholic Bible is the Bible?
Well, I was just going to recommend, I have a whole book on this subject. It's called The Bible is a Catholic Book. And so that'll go into a lot more detail than I can go into in a brief radio answer. So I'd suggest you get a copy of that. It's available electronically. If there are shipping issues, you could just get the electronic version. You won't have any shipping costs. In terms of a general approach, though, now, we're assuming the person is coming from a perspective of faith. I'm assuming the person is a Christian. I would have a somewhat different approach if they're a non-Christian. But assuming they're a Christian, I would say, okay, so it's great that you're a Christian. You accept the 27 books of the New Testament. How do you know those are the right books? Because there's not a list in the New Testament of here are all of the books that are canonical. The apostles never wrote that down. So how do you know what the publishers put on the table of contents are the right books? Well, you have to trust somebody on that, because the apostles didn't tell us. There are very few books of the New Testament that even refer to each other. I mean, Paul quotes Luke once. And there are a few references back and forth between Paul's letters. But even if you had all of the books of the New Testament referring to each other, that doesn't tell you that there are no others. And it doesn't tell you actually that any of the books of the New Testament are canonical. Because look at the Book of Mormon. As Christians, we don't accept the Book of Mormon as scripture, even though it claims to be that. So you ultimately need to ground your belief in the particular books of the New Testament in your trust of something, in your trust of God's guiding the Christian community to recognize those books. And then you move to the next step and say, well, how did that happen? How historically did God guide the Christian community to recognize the 27 books of the New Testament? Well, he did it over the course of about the first four centuries, because it wasn't until the 300s that this really got settled. It wasn't until the late 300s. And it involved a process where popes and bishops and councils discerned this matter based on what had been handed down to them on the basis of tradition from the apostles. So it was a process that took a while for God to guide the church. It was a process based on tradition. And it was a process that involved guiding the church's leaders, what we call the magisterium as Catholics, into recognizing these books. So then from there, you want to say, okay, well, then I need to trust the guidance that God gave to the church and its leaders. Well, guess what? They didn't only recognize the 27 books of the New Testament, they also recognized the books of the Old Testament, including the deuterocanonical books, or what Protestants sometimes call the Apocrypha. So you look at the same early discussions of the canon of the Old Testament and the New Testament together, and I mean, you have dissenters here and there on any particular book you want to name, but the people who recognized the books of the New Testament, especially the councils and popes who got involved, recognized the same books of the Old Testament that are in the Catholic canon today. But for more information, like I said, check out The Bible is a Catholic Book.
Joe, we only have a few minutes left and there's a lot of people in line. So could you ask your second question just real quickly?
Yes. Is it acceptable to know the name of your guardian angel or not?
Can you know the name of your guardian angel?
If your guardian angel were to tell you, then, you know, that's up to the God and the guardian angel. But it is, the church does not encourage people to seek out private revelations to try to find that out.
Anonymous, you are next. Thank you, Joe, for that call. Anonymous, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. My question is, after confessing, what are the requirements for making a full reparation? So to give you a bit of context, a few years ago, I was dishonest, basically, in business relations. And if I go back to the business now, years later, I might get like in really serious trouble. So what would be acceptable? Would it be acceptable to like give money to charity instead, or do I have to specifically go back to those businesses and try and make reparation? And also, what amount should I give? I can't accurately like measure the exact number.
Okay, Tim, thank you.
Okay, so it's great that you have a desire to make reparations here. That is very good. One does not have to go back to the individual people and try to make individual restitution to them if it's going to cause worse problems than it would solve. So one has to make a judgment call about what are the advantages and disadvantages of trying to make specific reparation, meaning going back to the person I wronged and trying to make it up to them. There may be ways that you could do that without having to out yourself as having wronged this person. For example, let's suppose you stole an apple from a grocery store. Well, it would probably cause worse problems than it would solve to say, I stole this apple or something. I mean, let's make it something they would prosecute you for. Let's say it wasn't an apple. Let's say it was a TV set from an electronics store. You stole a TV set. Well, they might prosecute you for that. So I wouldn't say you got to go tell them about that. But what you might do is go to that same store and buy a TV set from them, even if it's not for you, and then you could donate it to someone else if you already have one. You could give that person some business. If you wronged them in a business dealing, you may be able to go back and give them some business that's roughly equivalent to the harm that was previously done, and that would help them out without you having to out yourself. If that's not possible, you could make a charitable donation to an organization that does charitable work of some kind, either religious or non-religious. In terms of the amount, that's going to depend on what you're able to afford. It doesn't have to be exactly equal to whatever the amount was that you wronged somebody for, but you want to do something comparable if it's possible and reasonable for you to do so in your given your own circumstances. The basic thing is just make a judgment call. Your heart's in the right place. Figure out what would achieve the greatest good without causing undue harm including to your own finances. You don't have to bankrupt yourself to try to make restitution, but figure out what seems reasonable and proceed on that basis and trust God with the results.
Thank you, Anonymous. As I said, I'm going to keep moving because there's not that much time left and lots of folks on the line. Let's go to Tim in Boston, Massachusetts. You are up next, Tim. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good evening, guys. Good, happy Easter and God bless.
Thank you. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. So I live in a group home for disabled persons, and two of my homemates are roommates. One is in a wheelchair, one is blind. We were watching the Glenn Lucas Zapruder film tonight, and we were having a discussion about this, and I guess my question is more about advice. We got into a heated discussion. I frankly think that Ted is funnier than...
Wait,
Tim,
I'm sorry.
Tim, I'm not familiar with the stuff you're talking about. Do you have a particular question for me that you could put in the form of a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's just a movie that we sit through. Well, two out of the three of us watch. So we got in a heated argument and Mike stormed out of the room and it really turned.
I'm sorry. I just have a bad feeling about that call. You're going to have to call back again, Tim, when you have a question that you can ask. I'm going to go to Paul in Braintree, Massachusetts, listening on 1060 AM. Paul, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes. Hi. Good evening, Jimmy. Yeah. Happy Easter, both of you. By the way.
Happy Easter.
Yeah, Jimmy. The practice of intinction for people that don't know is the whereby you dip the body of Christ into the precious blood, and a lot of people don't know that. But I've seen it already occur in a lot of the private masses that I've seen streamed, and I have a feeling that this is probably going to be common practice going on. I want to know too, Paul, what does the church have a documented teaching on intinction? Is it basically up to the bishop? And do you agree that this is something that's going to be pretty commonplace going forward? Because
Okay.
The global pandemic.
So there's, in terms of intinction, the church doesn't have a document that says this is our teaching on this, but it does have liturgical documents that provide for intinction. So if you say, well, what's implied by these documents, they do provide and imply that intinction is a legitimate way of distributing Holy Communion in at least some circumstances. There will then be different regulations in different rites of the church because different Catholic churches, Melkite, Chaldean, Roman, all the different Catholic churches that have their own laws will have their own regulations for if and when intinction is to be used in that rite of the church. But stepping back from that and saying, well, what doctrinal implication can we draw? The fact that it's permitted anywhere by official Catholic liturgical law means that it's in principle a legitimate way of distributing communion. And it's just a question of what are the particulars of how it is to be used in what circumstances in different rites of the Catholic Church. Having said that, I don't know that the current coronavirus pandemic is going to increase the frequency with which the precious blood is distributed by intinction. One of the things about intinction is it has to be delivered on the tongue. And there's currently a discussion about does delivering communion on the tongue encourage the spread of germs or encourage the spread of sickness, or does putting it in the hand do that more? And that's an empirical question that I don't think any scientific studies have been done on. So it's really people just taking their best guess at this point. So I don't know what's going to happen in terms of will the coronavirus have an impact on the mode for the distribution of communion in the future. We'll have to see. And we can always, in the meantime, pray that God guides the pastors of the church to find the best solutions.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks very much for the question. I'm sorry to the we were working our way through them, but there's still a few on the line that we didn't get to. But we do this almost every day, so we'll ask you to call back during another show. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. You can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the internet. It's one of the best things on the internet. So just go to the internet, type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you can find it. Also, Jimmy mentioned his book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy, thank you very much. I really appreciate the hour.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett. Have a great weekend, and all the listeners too.
You too as well. And I got to go look. I'm going to go on the internet. I'm going to find out What can I do for Divine Mercy Sunday? Because I know you're supposed to, there's things to do on Divine Mercy Sunday, but I'm not going to be in church. That person put that in my mind. So have a very blessed Divine Mercy Sunday, everyone, and an ongoing Easter celebration. It goes on for days and days and days because God loves us so much and we're Catholic and we get to keep saying Happy Easter all the way right up to Pentecost. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. We'll see you next time right here on Catholic Answers Live.